the Moment Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Nancy Pelosi says there's no choice but to move forward with articles on impeachment. We'll map out red and blue game plans now that appears that for Democrats, there is no going back. Plus, while Disneyland is dubbed the happiest place on earth, find out why around this time of year, it might also be one of the yummiest places on earth. That and a lot more coming up when Take Two kicks off in just a few. Keep your ears here. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Thanks a lot for joining us today. Coming up, we discuss the incredible amount of data that's collected about us every day online and the new law that's going into effect soon that'll give you more control over all of it. Also, we check in on the redesign of the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. It got a green light from the city council this week, but that doesn't mean the process isn't without issue.
Some people have compared it to a mid-century modern coffee table. Other people have said it looks like an Italian restaurant.
Let's kick things off, though, this Friday with some state of affairs. That's our weekly peek at politics in the Golden State. And this week, Senator Kamala Harris is out of the presidential race. We'll hear what went wrong and what happens next. Meanwhile, as impeachment proceedings continue, we're going to take a peek at who's winning in the court of public opinion. So let's get into all those topics and more with Jack Pitney. He's a Roy P. Crocker Professor of Politics at Claremont McKenna College. Welcome back, Jack.
Good afternoon.
Also with us, Rachel Van Sickle Ward, Professor of Politics and Gender at Pitzer College. Rachel, welcome back to you.
Great to be here, eh?
All right, Jack, let's start with you on this. There's a lot of analysis out there looking at why the Kamala Harris campaign ended. They blame finances, but analysts say finances are a symptom, not the root cause. And LA Times contributor George Skelton says that anyone who watched her as attorney general could have predicted this outcome. So I ask you, Jack, I mean, was it predictable? Didn't seem that way to a lot of people.
She on the campaign trail is actually very appealing, but the trouble is winning at the statewide level doesn't necessarily predict success in a presidential race. 2010, good year for Democrats. She barely scraped by in a race against Steve Cooley. 4 years ago, when the Republicans were crashing, she was able to win, didn't have a strong opponent. Her Senate race, Republicans didn't even make the top two. She ran against Loretta Sanchez, but that really wasn't much of a feather in Kamala Harris's cap. Loretta Sanchez ran a terrible campaign. It was to political campaigns as the Emoji Movie was to cinema. her record in the state didn't necessarily portend success at the presidential level.
So, as I always do at times, I take it back to sports. A college football team that had an easy schedule before they got to the playoffs where it got a little bit harder?
Yeah, that's pretty much the Kamala Harris story.
In some ways. All right. Now, Rachel, there's a political side to why Kamala Harris isn't in the race, but a number of people say that gender and race were factors in why she had to suspend her campaign. Is there any way to quantify how much voter rejection was related to maybe a lack of a clear message versus factors out of her control, like how she looks and her skin color?
Yeah, those are really important questions. I mean, first of all, it's a little hard to talk about voter rejection because it hadn't actually been subjected to the voters. Clearly, her polling was very low, and that's an important metric. But I do also think it's really important to look at broader trends and structural biases that may have played a major role in her campaign. And one of the ways to think about this is even in the framing of her sort of supposed lack of a cohesive message. It's interesting because I think she actually talked about important policies, civil rights. She had a reoccurring frame about justice. She had a link between her prosecutorial background to the For the People message. So I think the message was potentially out there. I do wonder if that message was always reaching voters and kind of how that message was funneled. And in terms of trying to assess that, it's always tricky when you're looking at just one candidate. So one thing that can be really helpful is to look at races past, look at other times that women have run for president, that people of color have run for president. And one thing we see is that there just hasn't been that many Black women that have made it to the point that she has. So you have Shirley Chisholm in 1972 and Carol Moseley Brown in 2004. Those are the only two in a party that many observers will say has a lot of involvement with Black women. So I think it really forces us to ask the question, again, how much of it was campaign missteps, which are very important to talk about, and how much is the structural obstacles that women of color face?
So there's no playbook then, is what you're saying?
Yeah, I think A, there's no playbook, and B, the playbook is often evaluated after the fact in a way that really focuses on failures rather than obstacles.
And Jack, at play in this election, it really is undeniable, the theme of electability, which is a very squishy term. Some would say it's a very flexible term. Democrats are practicing some amateur punditry as they choose who to support. Are we consistently talking about this simply because Donald Trump is the other candidate?
Because a common theme among Democrats is I'm the person who can beat Donald Trump, and they approach it in
Michael Bloomberg has put that in his ads, all of his ads.
And Kamala Harris said, I'm going to prosecute the case against Donald Trump, trying to link it to her record as a prosecutor. And she would have been really effective in a general election debate against him. The problem is general election debates, as we found out 4 years ago, don't necessarily determine who wins the presidential race. Now, had she made different strategic choices, might the campaign have turned out differently? We'll probably never know that.
So, honey, Michael Bloomberg put that in his ads. I will beat Trump. So did Tom Steyer when his first ads rolled out, too. He put the same thing. I figured that's what they're doing, all of them, right? They're all trying to become the next president.
Yeah, and my former student, now a former presidential candidate, Steve Bullock, tried to make that point, saying he was the only candidate in the race who had carried a Trump state. And that was not sufficient for him to survive in the presidential race.
Rachel, can you maybe make the case that the concept of electability carries some kind of structural discrimination of some kind?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the first thing I'll say is it's certainly a logical thing to talk about. I mean, it makes perfect sense that candidates and potential voters and pundits are thinking about who stands the best chance against Trump. Harris also had an ad out that called her the antidote to Trump, right? He's a sex offender. I prosecuted sex offenders. So it makes sense. But I love the phrase that you use, sort of amateur punditry. What happens is that the phrase electability becomes kind of code for what we know and have seen before, which tends to be white male candidates. So it does tend to disadvantage women candidates and people of color. And moreover, it's just not particularly well supported by the evidence in the way that we talk about it. So we have plenty of examples of candidates like Barack Obama and Bill Clinton who early on were not perceived to be super electable and then ended up doing very well. And we also have candidates, you know, probably the ones that are getting the most electability hype are certainly Biden, and I would also say Sanders. Biden did terribly in his first two presidential runs. He really didn't do super well on the national stage until he was the vice president for Barack Obama. Sanders also came 4 million voters short in the last run that he had, which is not to discount these candidates' qualities or potential. It's just to say that when we talk about electability, it does sometimes become reductive and oftentimes just a way to reinforce our priors rather than a serious evaluation of candidate merits.
The funny thing with that word is that most of these candidates have won elections for a long time at different points in their careers, and we're still wondering about electability. Jack, a significant number of delegates next year are at stake. In states with large shares of Black Democratic voters. But an op-ed in the New York Times makes the case that Black voters appeared to reject Harris. There was that hashtag, Kamala Harris is a cop, that went around all over the place. Based on your research, were Black voters cold on Harris? And if so, why?
Well, just follow up on what Rachel said a minute ago. It's important to look beyond just Kamala Harris and look at, well, Joe Biden. It wasn't just a question of her weakness, but Joe Biden's strength. He had some weaknesses that she pointed out in their debate confrontation, but he was Barack Obama's vice president. He had a long history, chairman of the Judiciary Committee, and he has very strong support among African-American voters, and that is what made it difficult for Kamala Harris to break through.
Yeah, and she's trying to spend a lot of time in South Carolina, or at least focus on South Carolina, to try and boost that a little bit, especially with Black women. And yeah, nothing seemed to work for her. Rachel, that op-ed in Washington Monthly makes a case that TV and print media play a pretty big role in how the public understands presidential candidates. And because of that, their characteristics often end up getting funneled through white male-dominated newsrooms. Is there a specific instance that you can think of when this was the case?
Yeah, unfortunately, there are a number of them. I'll just give you a couple. There was a Politico article that made the claim she's connecting with audiences sometimes to a fault. It's really hard to know how to evaluate a statement like that. I mean, there are...
So that's a positive, right? But to a fault
to
makes it a negative.
Fault, okay. Right? And right. It kind of ties into this reoccurring theme we have with women candidates, which is somehow you're doing it wrong, right? You're likable, but not enough, or you're too likable, and that's a problem. And particularly with her, it got tied into a a perceived lack of substance. And I actually think it's really important to have a conversation about the policy chops that candidates have. I think what you see when evaluating her is that she was held to a different standard. For example, Buttigieg has said repeatedly, we shouldn't focus too much on policy. We need to think more about vision and values. Similarly, Sanders has said more than once, it's not important that I provide all the details for my healthcare policy. So I do think that in the case of her, it was a knock against her that was not necessarily experienced by some of the white male counterparts. I'll also say, unfortunately, that you see this since she's dropped out. So the Skelton article that we were referencing earlier has the tagline, her ambition exceeds her ability. Honestly, I think the overarching tone of that piece, unfortunately, was she really ought to know her place. And I think we have to be careful about frames like that. Now, it's one thing to say, you know, here is what she did and here's how we should evaluate it and criticize it. That is absolutely reporters' jobs. They should be consistently critical. But I think when you frame things like her ambition exceeded her ability, you start to play into these tropes where it's problematic if a woman wants too much and she should really sort of stay in her place and not be too ambitious.
All right. So now with her out of this race, California, big media market, TV ads still very, very effective way to reach voters. It costs a lot of money, though. And between the campaigns, Bernie Sanders has sent the most staffers here to drum up support. Who stands to benefit right off the bat with Kamala Harris's departure?
Not necessarily anybody in particular. There's new polling from Morning Consult that suggests that Biden, Sanders, and Warren each inherit about an equal share of the Kamala Harris support. So it isn't necessarily the case that there's one particular candidate out there who's going to automatically be the beneficiary of that. Where the staffers go, where the supporters go, that's another question, and we'll see what decisions they make in the weeks ahead.
We're talking State of Affairs with Jack Pitney, Roy P. Crocker, Professor of Politics at Claremont McKenna College, also Rachel Van Sickle Ward, Professor of Politics and Gender at Pitzer College. All right, so moving on, President Trump faced a 5 p.m. deadline today on participating in the next stage of impeachment hearings. In a sharply worded letter just minutes ago, the White House signaled they will not participate or mount a defense. And earlier this week, legal scholars weighed in on the basis for those hearings at the House Judiciary Committee. Rachel, what stood out to you from the testimony we heard?
It was really riveting. And, you know, I think it's important to focus first on what the ultimate accusations are. They're significant misconduct. This is from the impeachment report that just came out. Significant misconduct, accusations that the president subverted national security by withholding critical military aid to Ukraine. And what's important in thinking about this most recent testimony is the first stage of testimony was supposed to be about getting the facts out. So you had a lot of many career bureaucrats officials saying, here's what we witnessed, here's what we saw unfold. And this next stage was experts in constitutional law trying to contextualize those accusations to see if they merited impeachment. And what stood out for me was the sort of unanimity of the three judges that were called, or judicial scholars that were called by Democrats, in saying that it absolutely did amount to an impeachable offense. And then the other thing I found really striking about these recent days is Nancy Pelosi had a press conference where she was summing up the impeachment hearings. And as she was exiting the stage, there was a reporter that asked if she hated Trump, and she came back with a very fiery response. And what was embedded in that response was something that I think she's reiterated a number of times, which is, here are the things that I oppose Trump for doing, you know, denying the climate crisis, actions at the border, gun violence. Those are for the election. This is about the Constitution. So she's trying to draw this distinction between policy decisions that matter a lot, that have a lot of consequences, and a violation of the president's constitutional oath.
Yeah, she was walking off the stage and she went right back to that podium. Yep. It was a, oh no, you didn't kind of moment.
Yeah, it was a literal pivot. That's right.
Yeah, and part of that was she mentioned her Catholicism, and people may have wondered what that have to do with anything. Now, I was raised with the same Baltimore Catechism as she was. And the Baltimore Catechism is very specific that hate hatred is a grievous sin, a violation of the Fifth Commandment. And it's something that in my upbringing and my family was, you know, was very, very much emphasized. And she had the same kind of upbringing.
Now, of the four scholars who spoke to the committee, one tapped by Republicans cautioned against impeachment at the moment, right now. And that was George Washington University professor Jonathan Turley. He warned House Democrats against moving too fast on impeachment. Let's hear a clip of that.
It's not wrong because President Trump is right. His call was anything but perfect. It's not wrong because the House has no legitimate reason to investigate the Ukrainian controversy. It's not wrong because we're in an election year. There is no good time for an impeachment. No, it's wrong because this is not how you impeach an American president.
And he went on to say that the American public needs a chance to catch up with the proceedings. Jack, do you see a case for giving everyone a chance to catch up?
I think people are already caught up. The facts in the case really aren't that much in dispute. We pretty much know what Trump did. The case for delay is pretty weak because it involved interference in the election and the prospect of interference in the 2020 election. Michael Gerhardt said if the left unchecked, the president will likely continue in his pattern of soliciting foreign interference on his behalf in the next election. And that's a pretty strong case for acting with some dispatch.
Now, Rachel, to Turley's point, though, about it being too soon for Democrats to seek impeachment, if Republicans don't take part in this impeachment and then President Trump wins in 2020, and if he does something that sets off alarm bells again, could it be harder to get people behind proceedings a second time, another time?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think the first thing I want to do is really reiterate Jack's point that the facts are what they are and Congress has a constitutional duty to act. But you're right. There's, of course, a political dimension as well. And I think in thinking about that, one point to reference is recent polling. UCLA recently collaborated on a poll on this front, shows that Democrats are incredibly focused on this issue, and there is a lot of knowledge out there about how much it matters. And they're really in high levels of agreement that it's the right step to take. So I don't think that there's a really great case against moving forward. And again, even if there were polling against it, I think it's important that that Congress fulfill its constitutional duty.
One last thing, Rachel, real quick. Is it one of those things where if they're going to swing, they better not miss?
Well, I think it's a little hard to think about it in those terms, although they certainly make sense, because the reality is they have to swing when the ball is pitched to them, right? You know, the facts are out there. So you have to play the hand that's been dealt to you, and you have to do so in as clear-eyed a way as you can.
Sports, politics, and poker. It's all a state of affairs. That's Jack Pitney, Roy P. Crocker, professor of politics at Claremont McKenna College, Rachel Van Sickle Ward, professor of politics and gender at Pitzer College. My thanks to you both.
Thanks, A.
Thank you.
You might think nothing can surprise you anymore. The kind of information sharing we all take part in pretty much has made our personal privacy as transparent as a sliding glass door. Now, that's what I thought, too, until I heard how deep data brokers go to know things about you and how much they actually pay to get it. Coming up, find out why we're all about 3 weeks away from taking back control of our privacy. That's ahead when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC, I'm Amy Martinez. California has been looking to reduce its dependence on fossil fuels such as coal and oil and rely more on clean alternatives, wind and solar being two. And for some time now, natural gas has been marketed as the bridge fuel that can help us make that transition. But the Aliso Canyon gas disaster in 2015 threw all of that into doubt. A broken well at the underground gas storage field near Porter Ranch caused the nation's largest uncontrolled release of natural gas. And that put gas storage right under the regulatory microscope. This week, a trial of sorts began of the Southern California Gas Company's operation of that field. And here to walk us through this latest development is KPCC infrastructure correspondent Sharon McNary. Sharon, welcome.
Hey there.
All right, so let's put it right out there. Gas storage, a pretty arcane topic. Why does this matter to Angelenos at all?
Well, the very future of the gas we use to generate electricity and heat our homes could hang on the outcome of this trial and two other investigations underway at the California Public Utilities Commission. The natural gas we use, you know, comes from big pipelines from out of state. Because SoCalGas has a place like Aliso to store it underground in a depleted oil field, they can stock up on gas in the summer when it's cheap and then save it for the winter when there's a higher demand for gas and it costs more. So SoCalGas has four gas fields that serve our area. The biggest is the Aliso field near Porter Ranch. There's also gas fields near Valencia, Goleta, and Playa del Rey. But if the operation of those fields appears to be overly hazardous, their continued operation could be at risk.
And SoCalGas is on trial now over how it ran the Aliso gas field. So what's really happening here? This isn't a court trial like I would see on television, is it?
No. The California Public Utilities Commission, which regulates SoCalGas, received the opening testimony from the commission's Safety and Enforcement Division yesterday. That safety division acts kind of like a prosecutor. And the testimony is all in writing, 86 pages of scathing criticism of the way SoCalGas ran its gas storage operation. All the arguments and evidence from SoCalGas and the safety division and other stakeholders, that'll come out and unfold over the course of a year. And when it's resolved, the PUC will decide on what, if any, penalties SoCalGas must pay as punishment for the 2015 blowout and its mistakes operating the gas field.
86 pages of scathing criticism? I got to hear some of that.
Yeah. Some of the examples come from an independent inquiry published last May into the cause of the gas blowout. It wasn't the first time the company had leaks or corroded casings on its wells. But SoCalGas didn't bother to investigate why it was having these problems on 12 different wells. It would just fix them when they broke. So the company failed to properly anticipate the extent and consequences of corrosion on its wells, this prosecutor is saying. A lot of the kind of testing the company could have done to detect that its wells were corroding was available to SoCalGas. They just didn't do it. Things like having real-time continuous pressure monitoring of the gas in the well. Also, the company didn't understand the way the groundwater was corroding the outside surface of the well that finally broke open.
What about problems in the way the company responded to the blowout once it actually happened?
One of the most serious allegations by the PUC Safety and Enforcement Division concerns the crude oil that sprayed much of Porter Ranch during the 4 months that the blowout was active. People were reporting that oily black droplets were covering their patio furniture and playground equipment and the outdoor surfaces where their pets walked. The testimony says that SoCalGas knew the well was releasing crude oil and failed to disclose that to the LA County Public Health Department. Crude oil contains the cancer-causing chemical benzene. The World Health Organization says there's no safe level of benzene. And there are families in the Porter Ranch area who say in lawsuits that their relatives have been sickened and even died because the pollution came from the Aliso Canyon gas field during the blowout.
Wow. What other complaints are there?
The PUC Safety Division says SoCalGas also balked at cooperating with investigations, declining to provide documents, and even defying a subpoena to appear at a deposition.
What's SoCalGas's response to all this?
The company's full written response, its defense presentation, if you will, that's due sometime early next year. For now, the company says its operation of the gas field at the time of the blowout complied with the state and industry standards that existed back in 2015. The company also says that the Aliso field has been overhauled and it's now safer than any other gas field in the nation.
Now, remember you mentioned that this was just one of three investigations coming out of the Aliso Canyon gas disaster. What are the other two?
The legislature asked the PUC to figure out whether the LA Basin can get along, and that means if we would have enough energy available, if use of the underground gas storage at Aliso is minimized, or if that gas field could be closed entirely. And the other one takes a broader look at the safety practices of SoCalGas. So not just at Aliso, but at the other gas fields it runs, its pipelines, its overall distribution network. The idea being that if Aliso had all these problems, what's going on at other parts of the company?
Oof, and you'll be following it as it all unfolds. KPCC's infrastructure correspondent, Sharon McNary. Sharon, thanks a lot.
You bet.
All All right, switching gears. Whether you're shopping, searching, or posting online, you're leaving a trail of data right behind you, like a digital snail. And that trail has value. Advertisers pay good money to get their hands on this kind of information to better target potential consumers. But due to cyber attacks and privacy breaches, Americans have grown more and more concerned over how this data is protected. Enter Assembly Bill 375, California's legal response to these concerns. It puts more control of digital data in the hands of consumers. Now, the law goes into effect in just a couple of weeks, January 1st, so we called up Laurel Rosenhall at the news site CalMatters for an explainer on what it will mean for you. Welcome back to Take Two.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
All right, before we get into AB 375 and how it works, how much data is collected by, say, Google and Facebook?
Well, it's really hard to quantify exactly, but there was a writer who downloaded all of his data from Google and from Facebook last year and wrote an article about it in The Guardian. And it was pretty mind-blowing. He
Wow.
said the data that Google had on him was basically the equivalent of 3 million Word documents worth of information. And the Facebook data was amounted to about 400,000 Word documents. So that we're talking histories of every location he had been in the last year, including the time and date he had been there, a calendar of events that he had put on his calendar, as well as which ones he actually showed up to, every photo he'd ever taken with his phone, including information on when and where they were taken, as well as every email he'd ever sent or received, including the ones he deleted.
Oh, my God. Wow. Okay. So okay, that's a lot. That's a lot of information.
It's a lot.
And we just kind of just don't even think about it most of the time. So these sites have tons of data on their users. But then what? Are they the ones selling it to the advertisers directly? How does that part of it work?
There's a business model called data brokers. And those are companies that really do sell data. They, you know, scoop it up from a variety of different sources. Some of these companies are also the companies that check your credit when you're applying for a loan or an apartment. And there's other data brokers as well. And so they sort of collect information about people from a lot of different sources, mm-hmm. compile it together, and then they do sell it in ways that will be, you know, very useful to companies that are trying to sell products.
So these data brokers then, Laurel, what kind of information do the data brokers have?
Well, that can get pretty specific. You know, they may know how much debt you have. They may know whether you pay your rent on time. They may know how much money you have in your bank account, or, you know, whether you're planning a vacation based on, you know, some of your queries or search history. So the thing to know about data brokers is that most of them are not companies that are household names the way Facebook and Google are. And so a lot of those companies, we wouldn't really necessarily know that they're the ones that have this information and that they're the ones that sell it. And so that is one of the trickier things about data brokers. There was a review in Fast Company, the publication Fast Company, that found there's at least 121 data brokers operating in the United States. And like I said, most of them are not company names that, you know, your ordinary person would have heard of.
Now we're going to get into AB 375 in just a second. But before that, Laurel, how much do we know in terms of how much this data is valued at? What's the price? I mean, how much are we worth to these companies?
Well, there's not really one perfect way to put a price on it. At the very minute individual level, the fact that a woman is pregnant, companies that pay for personal data pay 11 cents for that little bit of information, knowing that what they can sell and target at a woman who's expecting a baby. So that's sort of at the most individual level. Another review found that a combination of 61 basic information items about us is worth $4.83 to a company. But if you start laying in much more detailed information, like your financial history, that for one individual is worth almost $300. So when you start looking at, you know, the entire population of California, the economists, they estimate that the value of personal information that's used for advertising in California is worth $12 billion.
Wow. It's funny, though, Laurel, it's not one of those things that I tend to think about too much. But now that you say it, that's all I can think about is that every little piece of me is out there somewhere being traded. We're talking to Laurel Rosenhall. She writes about politics for Cal Matters. All right. So we've outlined the problem. Now let's talk about how the state is hoping to give more power back to the consumer. That's AB 375. What does it do exactly?
It gives Californians a bunch of new rights and puts a bunch of new responsibilities on businesses. Fundamentally, it doesn't change the way that the businesses collect data about us, but it just gives Californians more ability to find out what they're collecting and to ask them to delete it if we want to. So the law is designed, honestly, really to put the burden on the consumer. If you do nothing, then nothing will really change other than you're going to get a ton of emails and notifications in the next month saying that companies you visit online have updated their privacy policies. But if you want to, starting on January 1st, you'll be able to contact any business and ask them to share the data they have about you and ask them to delete it. So those are sort of the two biggest changes. The third big thing is that for companies that do sell data, which as we talked about earlier, it can be very hard to know who those companies are, but for companies that do sell data, you will have the right to tell them to not sell your data.
Laurel, you think this is enough to actually spark a change in this ongoing online data and privacy concern that a lot of people have? Or is that digital privacy cat way out of the bag now?
So experts predict that we're going to see an emergence of a little cottage industry of privacy specialists, consultants, or digital services that basically you can pay to protect your privacy. The law does require that consumers go one by one to all these different companies to try to get the information, to ask for it to be deleted, or to ask for the data not to be sold. So experts are telling me that they think that we'll get to the point in the future where this is a service that's available, where you could either maybe pay a monthly fee and have your privacy checkup done for you once or twice a year. So I think we're going to see a lot of advances in this area in the, you know, 1 to 2 years ahead.
Laurel Rosenhall writes about politics for Cal Matters. She spoke to us today about California's new data privacy law that goes into effect January 2020. Laurel, thanks for taking the time. And we'll have a link to her article up on our website, take2.org.
Hey, thanks for having me, and hope people will check out Cal Matters for more information and links to how you can learn more about the data that companies have on you.
You know, LA's been pretty lucky with their sports venues. They've all aged really well. Think of the Coliseum and that amazing classic peristyle entrance, or even Dodger Stadium and the splash of color that fills your eyes when you see the stands from the parking lot. And they've both been around for over six decades. Well, there's a different kind of venue in LA that has not aged as well and is eyeballing a redo. The thing is, folks seem underwhelmed with its potential replacement. Find out all about it when Take Two continues. All right, if you think LA's local focus ends at the end of Take Two, you're wrong, because you know what? John Horn and The Frame get going at 3:30 today. They also got a Saturday show at 2. What is up, John?
Well, I'm going to talk about the weekend show, because I know as soon as you're done here, you're going to head over to Hot 8 Yoga Pasadena and do some Hot 8 with me. You're going to do some hot yoga?
With you, no. Alone,
anyway,
yes,
we have an interview with the director of a documentary about Beacom Chowdhury, who brought hot yoga to the States. The documentary is called Bikram Yogi Guru Predator. It's about his history of sexual assaults and harassment. We also have an interview with Mark Duplass. You probably know him as a filmmaker. He's also an actor. He's in a couple of projects that both have Me Too stories about Hollywood. Bombshell, which is a story about Roger Ailes and Megyn Kelly, and the new Apple series, The Morning Show. We are also talking to one of the actors in The Morning Show, Gugu Mbatha-Raw. She was in Motherless Brooklyn, and she's in The Morning Show. She also is in a really cool movie that not a lot of people have seen called Fast Color. Mm. So if you're bored this weekend, you could dig up Fast Color. I think it's on Amazon Prime.
I'm wondering, with Mark Duplass on the show, The Morning Show, if they purposely make sure that he gets no sleep before they shoot his scenes, because he has got like the weight of the world as the executive producer of a show. He should, but you know, that's
he does. Yeah. And this is the guy who has got so many, his hands in so many different things. I mean, he's directing movies, he's producing documentaries like Wild Wild Country. He's acting. He has this kind of indie film background. He's now making studio stuff. Interesting guy, and I think interesting conversation.
That's John Frame and the... There you go. I almost did it again.
You're stuck.
John Horn and the Frame, 3:30 weekdays and also Saturdays at 2. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm someone else. I'm not me. I can't say names. I'm not going to say my own right. Good art is supposed to transcend time and culture. The folks at LACMA also want art to transcend Wilshire Boulevard, too. As part of a project years in the making, the LA County Museum of Art is redesigning its campus, complete with one part of the new building stretching over traffic along Wilshire. Now, earlier this week, the project cleared a hurdle with the LA City Council, and if everything goes according to plan, it will open in 2023. But LA Times art critic Christopher Knight is with us to explain how that plan got splotches on it along the way. Welcome.
Happy to be here.
All right. Now, first, help us envision what this new LACMA is supposed to look like. We do have a sketch up it on our website, take2.org, but describe it for anyone that hasn't seen it.
The exhibition hall is an organic sort of blob that's raised on piers, single story that spans Wilshire Boulevard. Some people have compared it to a mid-century modern coffee table. Other people have said it looks like an Italian restaurant. There's been a lot of sort of humorous descriptions of what the building might look like.
This endeavor started in 2001. Why is it even necessary?
By the beginning of the new millennium, it was pretty clear that LACMA had outgrown the aging infrastructure of the buildings it had occupied since 1965, and then an expansion in 1986. And when Michael Govan was hired in 2006 as the new director for the museum, his mandate was to rebuild the institution. So the project that we're looking at today has really been underway for at least 20 years.
Yeah, wow. And so far, no shovels in the ground yet. What's been the biggest holdup?
Money is one of them. The museum made a plan or a self-imposed deadline, shall we say, that by the end of 2018, they would have $600 million in pledges secured on a $650 million project, but they didn't meet the deadline. They were about $40 million short. Since that time, there has essentially been nothing added to the fundraising.
And now you're reporting, Christopher, that the price tag is actually a lot higher.
Well, that's because there are two aspects to the building. There's the exhibition hall, which is $650 million, and then there's all of the rest of the museum functions. Those curatorial offices, administrative offices, research library, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All of that costs money. That's a shadow budget that has never been disclosed by the museum. The number that they're working with is at least $100 million.
So we're talking about a $750 million project altogether?
Yes.
Why have they stalled? What's been going on with not being able to get the funds?
That's a good question. The museum remains confident that they will be able to raise those funds. They are pushing forward with closure of the existing original campus, and they intend to get the wrecking ball moving within about 4 months. And my sense is that once the wrecking ball begins, there's no turning back.
We're talking to LA Times art critic Christopher Knight. Now, earlier this year, the LA County Board voted unanimously to back the project. And this week, the LA City Council did the same thing for a key piece of it. And it seems, Christopher, local officials have thrown their full weight behind getting this project done. What's driving that that desire there?
Well, I think once they committed to the project, gosh, at this point, it was 2 or 3 years ago. Once they committed to it, it's awfully hard for them to turn around and say, you know, wait a minute, we're not going to go forward with this. I think the city council approval of spanning Wilshire Boulevard, since the city of Los Angeles has the air rights over Wilshire Boulevard, not the county, the city had to weigh in on it. I don't think that was a surprise at all. I think it was fully expected. But what's done is done, and the political forces behind this are going to keep pushing forward.
Now, there are those who are concerned about the project. Who are the people concerned, and what are they most critical of so far?
The biggest concern is that the exhibition hall can never be expanded. As the museum continues to grow into the future, the idea of spanning Wilshire Boulevard, going from Hancock Park to a parking lot, essentially uses up all the available space as well. So you can't even put another building on the site. So the question is, well, this, you know, if this fits the needs of the moment, what happens in the future? And LACMA's answer is that it will open satellites around Los Angeles, and that I think is a highly problematic proposition.
So when you mean satellites, they'll take their art or their pieces and put them in different spots around the county.
Exactly. They'll break up the museum, essentially.
Well, but Christopher, then, is this a do-or-die situation, so to speak? I mean, where there is no choice maybe than just to plow ahead with the project regardless of all the challenges and obstacles? I mean, the alternative might be to keep this collection in buildings that seemingly will eventually fall apart.
Well, I don't think keeping the art in buildings that will eventually fall apart is obviously not an option and wouldn't happen. Uh-huh. For me, the big problem at the moment is that if this project doesn't go forward, in one respect, it's a disaster. And if this project does go forward, in one sense, it's a disaster. For me, there's almost a no-win situation at the moment, and I really don't know exactly what they should do at this point. I think the problems that they're facing are very large either way.
Christopher Knight, LA Times art critic. Christopher, thank you very much.
Sure.
All right, we all know Disneyland is the happiest place on earth. Hard to dispute that label. I don't remember ever being unhappy when I'm there. But find out why around this time of year, it also might be one of the yummiest places on earth. That's coming up when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Now, this spot in the show is usually reserved for our regular segment about eating. We call it Food Friday. But today's segment's about Disneyland, and even though I love Disneyland, I am required to hand it over to Take Two producer and resident expert of all things Disney, Lori Skywalker Galloretto.
Okay, step aside, A. So, we've officially entered the peak holiday season with all kinds of festive food and drinks coming out of their year-long hibernation to spread some holly jolly cheer. And it is plentiful at Disneyland and Disneyland California Adventure. The park's Festival of Holiday features 14 booths serving up Christmas-themed goodies. So, to help me discuss it all, I have Sarah Pineda with me. She is assistant producer for the KPCC LA's community engagement team, and as the carrier of a Disneyland Resort annual pass, she recently went to the parks to taste test everything and then wrote about it for LAS.com. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Lori.
So, Disneyland has a lot to offer during the holidays. Give us a sense of what the park is like during this time of year.
They have a 60-foot Christmas tree as soon as you walk into Disneyland to immediately get you in all your holly jolly vibes. They have Mickey-shaped garland across Main Street, and it looks so beautiful as you're walking down, and then you see the castle that has snow on top of it, so it's all types of magical. And in each land throughout the parks, they have their specific decorations to it. So if you go into Adventureland, it's themed like Jungle Cruise. If you're in Cars Land, you'll see Mater with a Santa hat, and it's so fun.
Ugh, it's so festive and truly the happiest place on earth during the holidays. But Sarah, we are here to talk about the food. So first, tell me about some of the entrees and some of the seasonal offerings that stood out to you.
Okay, so from November 8th to January 6th, Disney brings out all their seasonal dishes for the holidays. And at Disney California Adventures, they have a festival of holidays. So this includes shows, but most importantly, delicious food. And my favorite, and I know it's a favorite among Disney pass holders and guests, is the braised pork belly adobo with garlic rice. The pork belly is so tender and it pulls away every time you stick your fork inside of it. And it's just so perfect with every bite. It's a little bit salty, but the good kind of salt. And it's garlicky from the rice, so it's a great dish. And it's at the first booth as soon as you walk into the Festival of the Holidays, and it's really popular, so be prepared because it has a really long line, but you're at Disney, so
no,
so lines everywhere. Yes.
Lines for everything. How long do you think you waited for it?
Honestly, so it's kind of a trick because you look at the line and you're like, oh, this is really long, but you go up to order and it takes like 1 second, but the line you're waiting in is the line to pick up the dish.
Mm.
Yes, it's so long, but it's interesting and it's totally worth it. That's like the main point. It's totally worth it.
Okay, so say some people want to skip the wait and not everyone is a meat eater. Any dishes stand out that could be consumed by our vegetarian friends out there?
They do have vegetarian dishes. My favorite is the holiday pozole that you can find at Disneyland in New Orleans Square. Typically in pozole, they have meat, but Disney's is a vegetarian and plant-based version. So it comes with all the original traditional elements a pozole would have, like shredded cabbage, serrano chilies, radishes, and tortilla chips. But it's vegetarian, so it's really convenient. And they have a bunch of different vegetarian dishes all around the parks. A few for Festival of Holidays would be the Shepherd's Upside Down Pie that has plant-based ground beef. There's a pumpkin soup. There's a yellow curry rice plate. There's a bunch. So there's options.
There are lots of options. And you know what? I'm feeling quite full already hearing about them. But I always save a little room for a sweet treat. What kinds of fixins are they offering when it comes to dessert?
So I feel like you can't go to Disneyland without getting a churro. Like, it just wouldn't be right. Like, you couldn't fulfill your Disney trip without a churro. So for Disney this year, they have a churro that is milk and cookies churro. So it's one of their 8 seasonal churros. So if you love sugar, chocolate, cookies, and churro mixed in one, this is a perfect treat for you. The churro has chocolate chip cookie and cookies and cream sugar with a side of actual cookie chunks in vanilla icing. So you can dip your churro in that icing. And it's a dessert.
Yes. Sounds decadent. Sounds like you have to be all in for the sugar.
Yes. It's like, this is your dessert if you like sugar.
Amazing. And you know, by this point of the day, I'm imagining it's a little cold. I may need a little pick-me-up, something to keep me warm. Any recommendations on that front?
Yes. So Disney doesn't just pull all the stops on their food, but their drinks as well. For the Festival of the Holidays, they have a habanero hibiscus margarita that will definitely give you some heat to your chilly winter California night. It combines tart Jamaica with spicy habanero syrup, and it's rimmed with a chili powder. So the first time I took a sip from the habanero hibiscus margarita, I immediately made one of those, wow, this is spicy faces.
That sounds delicious, and I'm already feeling pretty cozy hearing about it. But this is just one of many combinations that you can get at the park. And Sarah, you tried a lot more. Where can we find more about it?
Yeah, I wrote all about it in a guide. You can find it at laist.com. That's laist.com.
And there are fun pictures there too, right? So people can actually see the food.
You can see it all.
Awesome. That's Sarah Pineda, KPCC's unofficial Disneyland expert and assistant producer for the KPCC LA's community engagement team. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
All right, finally, let's close out the show with a look into what to do this weekend.
I'm KBCC's Leo Duran. A. Martinez, I've got something for everyone this weekend, whether you are naughty or nice.
All right, let's start off with the nice.
Okay, so then treat yourself to everything that winter has to offer. Today through Sunday is Ski Dazzle. That's at the LA Convention Center. And this is the country's biggest ski and snowboard show. Now, as you know, only in the past few years, I have gotten really big into skiing.
You are.
Yeah, really big into it. It's really cool to show off to your friends elsewhere in the country that even in SoCal, you can go down the slopes. They're very surprised by it. So here at this event, check out the latest latest gear, plus you'll see all these special deals that resorts have to offer, then you can make plans to head to places like Big Bear, Mammoth, or the like on a black diamond or two. And when you go, tickets for adults start at $22, and for kids 12 and under, it is free.
All right, so what if I was a little naughty this year?
Like you royally forked up? Yeah, so fans of the NBC show The Good Place will know the reference. I said forked, like spoon and fork. Now, also, close your ears for a few seconds. If you haven't watched a series yet and you don't want a spoiler, okay, you good? All right, so the premise of this comedy is that four people in the afterlife are sent to what they think is The Good Place, but really, they were tricked and they were really in the bad place all along, those naughty scamps. Well, the stars of that show are in the bestest place on Sunday, the theater at Ace Hotel in downtown LA. They're putting on the Total Forking Shirt Show, because you can't swear in The Good Place or on KPCC either. It's an improv night with stars Kristen Bell, who is a KPCC member, by the way. The pledge drive is coming up, yeah. Wink, wink. Darcy Carden, Mark Evan Jackson, and more. Proceeds benefit public schools in Detroit, and tickets for that one, they start at $39.
All right, Leo, you know that I'm a boring kind of dude, so I'm in the middle of Naughty and Nice.
I know, I'm snoozing off right now.
Middle of Naughty and Nice. What about that?
Okay, so like it's like most of us. We're all sort of in this gray area. Well, we all deserve a nice time this weekend, no matter where we are. So head to the shore. First, at the Dana Point Harbor, it's the Christmas Boat Parade of Lights. That's tonight and tomorrow. Dressed up boats will float up and down the harbor for you to marvel at, starting at 7:30 each night. And don't worry about parking, because there will be free trolleys that take you and your family up and down the shoreline starting in the mid-afternoon. Plus, there'll be different kinds of activities to keep you entertained along the way. When you go to that one, it's free. And then, there's also another boat show. Lots of boats. The festive floats continue up the coast in San Pedro. There will be the 57th annual LA Harbor Holiday Afloat Parade. That is quite the mouthful. This one comes with a jury who will vote on the best. And there'll be viewing spots all along the harbor. So just stay close to the water and you'll be good. And this one's free too. Now, that is actually not all, The KPCC LA's gang have a lot more to share of what to do this weekend. You can check it out on LAIST.com. That is LAIST.com. And then you can find me on Twitter and also on the slopes at Leo Has a Cat.
And that's our own Leo Duran. Leo, thanks a lot.
See you later, A.
All right, that's it for Take Two this week. Our producers are Lori Skywalker Galaretta, Austin Cross, and Leo Duran. Austin and Lori directed the show this week. Carolyn Champlin helped us out with production this week. Tamika Adams is our news apprentice, the program engineered by Hazmik Pogosian. Our senior producer and editor is Megan Larson. I'm A. Martinez. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram, same place, A. Martinez LA. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back Monday at 2. Talk to you then.